Our speaker this evening, Dr. Caroline Madin, is the inaugural All Shall Be Well Professor in Religion and the Director of the Institute for African American Studies at the University of Georgia. Her research interests are in arts and literature, particularly in Southern and African American women's religious experience. And she has written extensively on Toni Morrison, Harper Lee, and others. Other research interests also include religion and politics, theory from the classical to the postmodern, and the intersection of classical and modern literature. Caroline is a graduate of the University of Virginia and teaches courses on religion and literature, African American religions and literatures, religious theory and thought, and women's spirituality and writings. So please join me in giving a warm Kentucky welcome to Caroline Madin.
When I heard Vincent Harding gave the first lecture, I thought, maybe I'll just leave now. Vincent was quite somebody. He and my teacher, Charles Long, were of that first generation of black scholars in the Religion Academy, and being around them, ooh, it was something. Anyway, I don't think I'm as powerful as they are, but I'm going to give it a shot. Ashish Nandi is an Indian psychologist and politician, and he argues that in every culture that goes rabid, there's always a force that runs beneath, that's linked to the culture, that can make a critique of and undercut the rabid destructive power. Nandi's point is that those oppressed should resist being tempted to fight within the rules and limits set by the oppressor. Instead, the oppressor should unearth, reclaim, and reinvigorate marginalized and discredited knowledges, seeking through lines that mark non-imperial forms of being in a culture. This is to seek and to reactivate the common, as Fred Moten and Stefano Harney write about it in their work, The Undercommons, Fugitive Planning and Black Study. The task is to seek the common, found in places beneath, underneath, within institutions of control, and to cultivate it with those of like commitments. These potentials are generally ungovernable. They're beyond and beneath and before enclosure, in some space that has no space, that offers refuge. So the commons, the undercommons, is not a place. It's a kind of ungovernable motion within that is simultaneously without. And it develops a kind of fugitive interplay with culture and politics. And this interplay, Harney hopes, generates freedom. As I thought about this lecture, this is what I think Thomas Merton and Martin Luther King are doing. Moten and Harney are talking about teaching a lot, but they call this work prophetic, the call from those who have what they call bifocal vision. The forthtelling of the prophet can see the disaster on the point of taking place in the here and now, usually before anybody else can see it. The prophet speaks so that human beings will wake up. Prophets judge the here and now from the point of view of the future. They offer a direction and urge us, as Richard Rohr puts it, to give up this stupidity and violence and to avoid the repetition of destructive pasts. King and Merton, two prophets from the undercommons, address, among other interlocking issues, racism and violence. They both saw themselves as located or living in a Kairos moment, one in which they urged Americans to address and redeem nonviolently the, for Merton, heretical social evils that will destroy us if we do not undertake a radical revolution of our values. Though they never met in person, though they hoped to, I'll talk about that at the end, they found an undercommons and experienced what Moten and Harney call hapticality, a word that they take from these things. That's why he said silence. See, if I silence mine, because my mama going to call me in about 5 minutes. That's how my mother is. She's the worst timing in the world. But it's a word that they take from digital technology to describe that sense of touch we experience through the vibration of the phone, for example. These vibrations are forces that call us to generate connection, right? We can't resist them. I think of this as kind of tuning into a frequency. As Ralph Ellison writes at the end of Invisible Man, the protagonist of that tale tells us that we have ignored his prophecy. He writes, "Being invisible and without substance, a disembodied voice, what else could I do but try to tell you what was really happening when your eyes were looking through?" And then he invites us into the undercommons. "Who knows, but on the lower frequencies, I speak for you." This kind of frequency gathers, though, it makes us tune in, right? And it gives us the capacity, Harney and Moten, and Motenhope, to feel through each other, to come to understand what is already here, or at least to try to join it. The first thing I want to talk about is deserts, islands, mountains, hush harbors, and sails. I'm thinking with Jacques Derrida, of course, who asked two questions. What binds us together? And in what name do we speak? For Derrida, the island, the promised land, and the desert are aporetical places, places of aporia, with no way out, without any secure path, without itinerary or point of arrival, without an exterior with a predictable map and calculable program. These spaces, and if you think about, for the students, if you think about going through a kind of ritual, if you've been baptized or confirmed or something like that, there's that moment in which, if you're Baptist, for example, and you, like in my tradition, they just hit you with some water and it's done. But in some traditions, they put you under, right? And that going under is what Derrida's talking about. It's that unmappable moment in which you're being transformed. When you come back up, you're a different person. And these spaces remap, recalculate, and reshape our horizons as they force us to face the ways that we distort infinity. They open us up to what is yet to come. I think the cell is that certain kind of space. And both Merton and King in cells seek the promised land, that essential bond between the promise and history, standing at a point at which relationships are both tense with power and yet utterly perfectible. In these aporetical spaces, the names that we are given as our heritage, ones that we use in our infinitude to try to reign over the world, come under tension, deconstruction, and interrogation, and alternatives present themselves. There we face questions that make us think about, how do you know what you're thinking? How do you know what you know? And does your thinking make life more humane? And the question that they're asking in what I want to talk about tonight, their letters, is, do you really think black folk ought to wait? Do you really think the white liberal should avoid the unmaking of a just world just to keep things calm? In the cell, for Merton and King, recognizing this aporia, this remnant, they want us to recognize the remnant of what is choretic, what is original in our epistemes, like Nandi was talking about. What parts of culture can we access that can help us to become free? They want us to think through their perfectibility, and they want us to also think through the imperfectibility of some ideas, like race. Ideas that don't have to be sanctified, theologized, or cultivated anymore. The two of them break the boundaries of the cells, their cells. So two men sit in cells, one in the Abbey of Gethsemane and one in Birmingham, Alabama. Both contemplate the problem of race and both write letters. Thomas Merton writes directly to white liberals. Martin Luther King Jr. writes to clergy, most of whom are white. King is actually imprisoned. As a black man, even one of his social class, he experiences the plight of the slave in a captive society, prepared by that society for imprisonment. Both men, however, are confined, and the solitary confinement of the cell becomes both a place of solitude in which they can find voice that reaffirms humanity and a call to that humanity as each articulates the cause of violent white racism. These cells are spaces of freedom and prophetic speech. Writing letters, Merton and King find and form an undercommons, a worldly space in which to be in solitude together. As Merton puts it, a gathering together in a place where we can think, pray, and experience presence. Both are calculating the cost of racism, of refusing the presence of the other. I always have to say that I'm thinking with bell hooks, another Kentuckian, and naming our episteme as what she calls the imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist, cisgender patriarchy. Later, someone added theistic, and the rise of Christian nationalism makes me wonder if that person is not right. What Hooks is warning us of, what King and Merton are warning us of, is that we're creating death worlds, practicing what Achille Mbembe calls necropolitics, that creates what John Paul II called a culture of death, a culture that is a consumptive totality fed by suffering and death, and not just black death. On this, King and Merton muse. Both their letters can touch us if we let them. They're kind of like this thing. When it shakes, we want to pick it up. And I think that's what they're trying to make us do. First King, thinking strange thoughts, King's vision from the cell. We have to remember that the black church, black religion, as it came into the new world, depended on the undercommons. It depended on the hush harbor. I know it's sometimes called hush arbor, but I prefer harbor, a space of docking after the unrelenting movement of slave trafficking. And it's finding a safe place to worship, finding community, being able to be each together with each other, to comfort each other. It was a commons, one that undergirded in its form of the black church, the civil rights movement. King practiced retreat. He was a practiced undercommons. He was a really interesting person, but his space was not the desert. He went between 1964 and 1967 to an island. He went five times to a place off the South Carolina coast. It's called the Penn Center. It was the Penn School at first. It was founded in 1862 by Quakers, and when King would go there, it was still controlled by Quakers. The center is on St. Helena Island off the coast of South Carolina. And King stayed in Gantt College, and Gantt College was named for a former slave, Hastings Gantt, who got rich and gave 50 acres for the center. What it did at first is the Penn School, it was a freedman's school, so it has a history of disruption, actually. A retreat house was later being built for King's use, but it wasn't, and it's there now if you go. But it wasn't completed until 1968, and so King was never able to use it. There at the Penn Center, King would gather his undercommons, and it included white artists like Joan Baez, and it also included the staff of the SCLC, all the people that he was working with. Conversation was open and free. Taylor often says it was very loud. We've got, if you go on the website, you'll see pictures of them singing together. Of course, Joan Baez was there, so of course. And at the center, this was one of the few places in the South where mixed race groups could meet safely, because it's really hard to get to Parley. If they had had the retreat center, you would have had to use a boat to get to it. So they were really thinking through King's safety being there. It was there that he and his team planned the March on Washington, and it was where King wrote the I Have a Dream speech. But though King would take his team on retreat, he had a really hard time taking personal retreat time for himself. He recognized early, and he was so young, but he recognized early that he needed solitude for the integration of his thought, but he really couldn't make himself take the time to retreat, concentrate, and reflect. In a profound statement, he recognizes that his whole life, as he wrote, seemed to be centered around giving something out and only rarely taking something in. He recognizes that the pace of his life and the tensions he negotiates will do harm to him as a person and potentially will harm the movement and his family. And you have to, the thing that always strikes me is the night that he found out he won the Nobel Peace Prize, he was in the hospital for a checkup after many months of exhausting activity. My hero, Howard Thurman, went to King in a hospital. King had been stabbed. And Thurman, the only time they talked, Thurman went to him and said, you need to think about whether this is really what your calling is. You need to think about if this is really the thing that you want to do. I think all this activity shaped the King that we know, the King that we imagine. We're used to King in our time as a voice. He's usually saying, I have a dream today, right? That's pretty much all we know. Professor and Pastor Maurice Wallace, in a brilliant book, it's called King's Bravado, in an interview said that King's is a voice that we cannot not hear. I think that's a really interesting thing to think about. It has incredible beauty and breathtaking range, but sometimes he says that we hear King's sound and not King's words. He says King's voice makes us realize that something else is there beyond or before the meaning of the words. This quality, Wallace argues, comes from King's capacity to listen as well as his capacity to speak. Even as he's speaking, he's acting as a medium, as a prophetic voice, and his vibratory haptics summon us into the undercommons, leading us to what we cannot hear ourselves. So how odd it must have been for those who were used to hearing King to read Letter from a Birmingham Jail, to be drawn into this jail cell. The letter on one level is a very intimate work. It's written to the fellow clergy in Birmingham. On another level, it is, as Merton letters are, Pauline and very canonical. In its beauty, it brings our attention to the politics of the real world. The letter, and we don't write many anymore, but the letter is a powerful form. It can narrate epics, create ideologies, and save damned souls with the intimacy of one-on-one dialogue. Writing a letter for King is really important because it presumes there's a self there, a black self. It's like the slave narratives, that there's a person there who's doing self-life writing, but he's doing it in a context. So the letter is almost like a diplomatic document at the same time. The balance of the personal and the political, I think, is beautiful. The letter does many things. It explains nonviolent action. It aligns the movement's call for social justice with accepted historical thought and philosophical thought. He invokes Jesus, Socrates, and he hopes to call on the conscience of the fearful, disengaged, and racist to recognize our interconnectedness in Christian and political terms as neighbors and citizens. The issue is urgent, he tells us. We cannot wait. And most provocative for me is how he humanizes the pain that racism has caused. I'd love to read it all, but I just want to read what he says about his children, because I think that was a vibration that he hoped would resonate with anyone who was reading the letter. He writes, perhaps it's easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say, wait. But when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that's just been advertised on television. And you see tears swelling up in her eyes when she's told that Funtown is closed to colored children, and see ominous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her little mental sky, and see her beginning to distort her personality by unconsciously developing a bitterness toward white people. When you have to concoct an answer for a five-year-old son asking, "Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean?" When you're humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored, when your first name becomes nigger and your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, and your last name becomes John, and your wife and mother are never given the respected title of Mrs., when you're forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. King suggests that it's not just overt actions like these that also create perpetual terror. He's asking us to think about what it means to live in a negative, uneasy peace, what the theorist John Galton calls a frozen peace, that desires to maintain the absence of tension and that accepts violence for the sake of order. King, I think, thinks this is just as bad or worse, and Merton will comment on it as well. This is the stance King is suggesting in this letter of the white moderate who doesn't challenge the racist episteme, who asks those who are suffering to let equality come in time. This is the time, King says. We can't wait no more. King is actively speaking to these moderates, especially those in the white churches, and he's showing them that they're members of a race that has oppressed another race, and if we believe what Jesus taught, we ought to be out front in the demand for justice. And finally, in the prophetic mode, he predicts judgment. The judgment of God is upon the church as never before. To unfreeze this episteme, King suggests we must create tension in creative nonviolence to mark the places of injustice and to guide us out. And he invokes Socrates, out of the cave, the dark depths of prejudice and racism, we must negotiate, dialogue, and converse. King calls attention to where he is at the beginning of his letter when he tells us he's confined. And he calls attention at the end. "Never before have I written a letter this long," he writes. "I can assure you it would have been much shorter if I had been writing from a comfortable desk. But what else is there to do when you're alone for days in the dull monotony of a narrow jail cell other than write long letters? Think strange thoughts." I love that. "Think strange thoughts and pray long prayers. What else is there to do? Create an undercommons." In prison, he's teaching as he draws attention to the carceral state that for black people began with the slave trade. He reminds us of the carceral archipelago that reminds us as black folk, and it reminds us what we're seeing right now with ICE detainees who are being put on islands and camps and labor colonies. What else is a plantation but a labor colony? To undergo the mechanisms, technologies, knowledge systems, and networks that are the function of death worlds, that accept that some will be slaves of the state, whose deaths are ungrievable, but also, as Marie Gottschalk reminds us, that creeps beyond the prison gate to draw us all into the panopticon. We risk our souls when we accept poverty, hunger, cold, lack of medical care, overcrowding, sexual exploitation, and other degradations as model and normal without batting an eye. From the undercommons, Moton and Haney argue that we are in a state of endless war. Pope John Paul II warned that this war is the powerful against the weak that creates and consolidates actual structures of sin which go against life. This subjects the moral conscience of the social and the individual, putting us in an extremely serious and serious mortal danger, that's Pope John Paul, in which we confuse good with evil. It is a perverse idea of freedom, he says, that imprisons us all. We are called on in this moment, King prophesies, to choose. King, I hope, broke the bars with his sound. Like St. Anthony of Korma in his life, he draws us into his cell, momentarily out of the logic of the episteme to examine its outcomes. He takes us, as his voice does, I hope, into the something else before the meaning of the words, into an aporia that might open possibilities. King thought strange thought. Merton tells us he has strange hopes. Merton, in Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, wrote, "The demand for absolute liberty brings men to the depths of slavery. The master of the machine becomes its slave." Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter comes in cool. That's Martin. His is the voice of the pastor statesman. It startles me to know that he was only 27 when he wrote that letter. Yeah, I know. The women in the front are going, 27? When I was 27, I couldn't do nothing. Merton's letters to a white liberal in Seeds of Destruction, really come in hot. Victor Kramer, in his work on Merton's poetry, writes that Merton wrote to make sense of an insanely overconfident world, uniting from his cell with the poor, the disadvantaged, and the forgotten. The metaphor of seeds, then, stands in tension with the culture of death. How do we embrace the seeds of life and find renewing seeds in a culture of death? Think back to Nandi. What have we done before that worked? How do we embrace the seed of life? Seed for Merton is presence and potential. In Seeds of Contemplation, he asks, how can we be good soil so as to receive the seeds of freedom if we are in love with slavery? He writes, Merton taught me a lot about this. He writes, God cannot plant his liberty in me because I'm a prisoner and I do not even desire to be free. I love my captivity and I lock myself in desire for the things I hate, and I have hardened my heart against true love. What we love and worship is the self and limited things, which for Merton is to worship nothing. It's to worship absence. And the worship of absence is hell. Cultivation of our seeds is our way of learning to recognize the call of God in all that is, and from the depths of our own being. King's sound echoes the voice of God. That's something that is there before the words. If we respond, we, Merton argues, can find the resonant sound, the word in us, and echo it. We can respond to God, answer God, echo God, and even in some way contain God and signify God. Becoming a living prayer, we as friends, I'm a Franciscan, I came in and there's the San Damiano cross. So I think Francis is in the room. Becoming a living prayer, we Franciscans understand that we should find God in all things. And if we can find God in all things, we can be with God always. Since Merton was fascinated with Zen, he might have understood, as Thich Nhat Hanh explains, that our reason and choice enter here. Well, he would have. We, like a gardener, have to choose the seeds we cultivate. We have to touch. That's another Zen metaphor. When you touch something, you become aware of its reality in Zen thought. And in Zen, that then connects to your heart, mind, and you begin to recognize that you're one with everything in interbeing. You experience the vibration, the haptics of the world through touch. In Seeds of Destruction, this is when Merton getting mad, he tells the white liberal that in cultivating the seeds of racism, you are cultivating death. This is to cut off the future. The problem, he writes, is this. If the Negro, as he actually is, enters wholly into white society, then that society, this his italics, is going to be radically changed. Merton argues, we were talking about this, that Southerners know this, and all Southerners know this, black, white, and everybody, right? And many Southerners actively resist the change in Merton's time and in ours. The growth into a new society. But he's arguing that this evil of racism runs throughout our whole country. This is Merton. This evil is not something purely and simply confined to white trash in the South. What is open and expressed in the South may perhaps be hidden and implicit everywhere in the nation that is so fascinated with violence and with the myth of power that it seems to have lost interest in anything else. The white liberal, Merton argues, will destroy the world rather than experience change. But the white liberal fails on another, more subtle level. The lens of white supremacy, which Merton sees as insecure and self-complacent, first makes the white liberal think that black human beings see equality as becoming white. This idea is ludicrous, Merton argues. This surprised me, Merton saw this, that black freedom is only going to be an approximation of whiteness. And second, Merton argues that the freedoms that white society is offering are only imposed gross and subtle forms of alienation. So you can only approximate whiteness, never live as equals, right? And which whiteness, Merton says, must remain the center. He also recognizes, and this is like Jim Brown dying first in the movie, he also recognizes that in this self-centeredness, white men expect their sins to be expiated by black forgiveness through a genuine response to the redemptive love of the Negro for him. Merton wouldn't put it this way, but black suffering for whiteness is normative. The idea that black people must supply the answers and suffer to free white people worries Merton, and it worries me. The answers black leaders like King, he argues, are providing to these questions are questions that white liberals would not even begin to ask. They don't even see it as part of the argument. And Merton, I think, is making a subtle point here that's worth mulling over. He asks us to recognize that the answers that King is giving are good and right because they're about politics, yes, but they're also spiritual answers. King, they cannot be heard, Merton says, because in the sense of being understood by a culture that's obsessed with power. The answers King gives are automatically translated immediately into politics, while the issues are really spiritual and religious issues. If we keep doing this, he tells us, the moment of grace will pass without effect, and it has. The merciful kairos of truth will turn into the dark hour of destruction and hate, he writes. In other words, we will remain in war to maintain evil convictions about power. Like King, he argues that the moment is now. Kairos for Merton is linked to vocation, and Merton suggests to the recognition of the role one must play in one's time. There are times he romanticizes black slave spirituality. He talks about it as unconscious and primitive. This is just the language of his moment, I think. But what he recognizes in black spirituality is an openness to the divine in myth, symbol, and prophecy. And he names King as a poet who is also a seer. There's no revolution, he declares, without prophetic song. And finding that prophetic seed, black people can, people who are oppressed, can cultivate what he calls numinous power, power that has a different vibration than that of the world, breathing in and expressing the spirit of God to escape bondage. Merton calls white people, not just in America, but the whole Western world, to see that they are in bondage. Their own lives under the episteme are empty, pointless, absurd, and totally lacking in freedom. We're enslaved to stuff, to consumerism, which he calls organized greed, to conceptions of labor and of time that support these illusions. He writes, all white men together, in spite of their fantasies of innocence, are prisoners of the same illusion, seduced by their own slogans, obsessed by the voice of an inner demon. They have no better alternatives than the passivities and oral fantasies of the consumer's dream world and the violent barbarities with which they react when briefly awakened to all that threatens to contradict their infantile dream. Merton does not ask black folk to save him or love him or forgive him. That's your own work. One of my husband's a deacon in the church, and he had a professor who said, Jesus went to hell and he freed everybody there. Now if you go to hell, it's your own damn fault. I think that's what Merton is saying. He recognizes that though what Birmingham represents is true, without taking that truth seriously, we cannot be free. To act in the historical moment is risky, but the risk, as he puts it in The Christian in the Diaspora, is necessary so that the future is not mortgaged to an unchanging present. If we reach out to the enemy who is in the abyss, God will reach out to both of us. I was trying to finish this fast, but I'm not doing a good job. Sorry, y'all. Promised Land. In the cell, King and Merton are practicing the Promised Land, standing where relationships are both tense with power and ripe with potential. They invite us into this refuge, into the undercommons where we must decide to what we are bound. This movement is not to move, not to leave the world, but it's to move to its edge, to its border, where we expose conceptual thinking to its death, to its finitude. I think this may be why the Desert Fathers in their cells fascinated Merton so much, and why for King, the Black Church and the Penn Center were so important. King and Merton, like most of us in the undercommons, are scrap and margin people. Harney and Moten write, "These are the other ones, we think they're crazy, these are the other ones carrying bags of newspaper clippings, or sitting at the end of the bar, or standing at the stove cooking, or sitting on a box at the newsstand, or speaking through bars, or speaking in tongues. These other ones have a passion to tell you what they found, and they're surprised when you want to listen, even though they've been expecting you." King wrote his letter from Birmingham jail on scraps of paper, including toilet paper and margins of newspapers. His lawyer smuggled the fragments out. His lawyer's name was my father's name, Clarence Jones. King's secretary and chief of staff reassembled the pieces. Merton wanted to be a hermit, dwelling on the margin, the fringe, and the paradoxical identity of monastic hermit. This is how the undercommons works. Its message from the edge is nevertheless engaged. Those in it study and plan. Their knowledge is seen as degraded, but if we listen to them, they say, "Come, let's plan something together." The undercommons do not call us to order, only to each other. Actually, if we desire to be in the undercommons, we probably will look around and realize we are already in it. We may find that we are always already in the thing we call for and that calls us, mostly because those in the undercommons are not capable of being disinterested. We recognize on some frequency and perhaps act in relation to the singularity of the other that calls you, at least in a spirit of duty and responsibility, if not in friendship, to care for the neighbor. I want to say a word about the cells and then I'll move to the end. I don't want to talk all night. This is terrifying. And it's terrifying because it's metanoia. It's turning around and away and towards something. It's, in Pali, a refuge is, in Sanskrit, a refuge denotes a house. And when King was, at the end of his life, he was writing about the world house. He was calling us to create freedom together in this world house. Cells like those of the Desert Fathers and Mothers whom Merton venerated and of the kind that King was locked away in were never safe. Merton, in his course on John Cassian, that's one thing Merton and I share a love of, told his students the desert was a place of deeper and more spiritual temptation, not just a refuge from the world. So it's a place of challenge. Christian Rupp in Desert City and Country reminds us that the desert is a threatening place. It was the location of the tombs of the dead and therefore of religious pollution. It was a place the old gods fled. Christians called them demons, and they no doubt tortured King in his seventh floor steel cell when he was held in confinement. In the aporia, in the desert, on the island, in the cell, we're called to choose. You have to die to something, and you might really die when you undertake a journey that risks your life as you know it. You face the deep questions. Do I run or confess to the angel Gabriel that I cannot read? Do I go into the deep memory of all my past lives and face all I have been and done and wake up, or do I just go home and become a king? Do I risk growing horns because I'm in the presence of God, never able to show my face again to other human beings? Do I jump off the parapet and die in this moment, but to recover the whole world and rule it like a king? To choose this path opens up transformation. To refuse it, well, I think we see what's happening now. I'll say this and then close. Nonviolence, I think, that Merton and King are calling us to is a practice of faith. It's to endure suffering under pressure. It is to hope, to believe that we can live otherwise, and it is to love an unloving other to the degree that you will expose your face to him across a line, not dictating how he will receive it, but hoping he will allow himself to be taught. Such love is disarming. It is an insistence on righteousness. All right, I'm gonna say this, then we can talk. I love to talk to students. I'm glad some students are here. There was an almost planned retreat that never happened to bring together Merton and King, two men who were committed, as I hope what I've talked about a little bit here, to a theology of love and hope, and thereby of self and world. Both King and Merton worked with June and John Youngblood. They were co-directors of the Quaker House in Atlanta, Georgia. And June particularly thought King in 1968 needed a retreat. He needed refuge. So she worked out a meeting between King and Merton. And she wrote to Merton later to confirm that this meeting was actually going to happen. King was coming to Gethsemane. But it never happened because King was assassinated on April 4th, 1968. And then Merton died in December, after that, of course, but they never met. Merton was devastated by the loss of King. He wrote a letter to Mrs. King. He made June tell him everything about King's funeral. I think it's kind of left us to imagine what might have come out of that meeting of two spiritual superstars. They wouldn't have liked that, but they were. Who knew what they were living for and sought to know what kept them from living for it. M. Sean Copeland described them as watchmen and witnesses. And Merton had bigger plans, too. He was going to gather the undercommons. King, Vincent Harding, and I imagine King suggesting his Vietnamese brother, Thich Nhat Hanh. They fell in love with each other just after meeting each other in two meetings. What would they have done and said? I don't know. I'm sure they would have talked about love and action in the kingdom of God that is hand. And I think they probably would have talked about what Teresa of Avila wrote, that Christ has no hand but ours. But you know, I hope they just would have been still. I hope they would have told stories. I know they would have smoked, because King and Merton smoked. I hope they would have laughed a lot. And I hope they would have come to see more surely that it's okay to stumble in the dark when our human institutions trip us up, and to trust in God, because God would catch them, because they were two people in whom, and this is from one of Merton's poems, God had planted the seeds of his undivided power, buried his thoughts too vast for words. They were two who together had discovered, shared, and passed on flame. All right, let's ask some questions. Oh,